Hi, welcome to 10,000 Posts. It's the show about how everything is posting and how life as we know it all centers around new, like a small amount of platform overlords who are also big babies. Maybe we'll be able to talk about why they're big babies in later in the episode. But for now, if you're joining us for the first time, my name is Hussein. You can follow me at hkisvani on twitter.com, where I talk about posts and how everything is posting. As always, my co-host, Phoebe Roy. Phoebe, how's it going?
It's going okay. I don't have anything to report.
Please don't tell me we've lost her. Please don't tell me we've lost her.
Can you not hear me?
Oh, there you go.
Okay, we can hear you now. Okay, Phoebe, do you want to just like jump in now?
Literally all I said was it's going okay, I have nothing to report, but now I do have something to report, which is that my internet is not working.
Yeah, just as background to this, right? So like Zencaster, the platform we usually use to record stuff, has just decided not to work for some reason. So we now have to use this thing called Zoom. You may have heard of it as being the pandemic's favorite app, but it's horrible. And like, unless you have like pitch perfect internet, like it just basically just doesn't function. So we're gonna have to be very patient with Phoebe today. Hopefully your connection will sort of like behave itself a bit. But we are joined by a guest today to talk about platforms actually, and to talk about why maybe platforms don't work as well as they should do and what the reason for that is. One of a very good tech writer who has written two books, one on YouTubers, another one on TikTok. It's called TikTok Boom, China's Dynamite App and the Superpower Race for Social Media. It is Chris Stokel-Walker. Chris, how is it going? Welcome to the first time on the Post Pod.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I am a big baby, but in a different way, in that I just enjoy all the things on the internet. I'm not into any of that like weird adult diaper stuff, for the record, just to immediately head off that thing. I realized when I said it that I was heading down a dangerous path. But yeah, I'm good. I'm excited to talk about how all tech is terrible, essentially.
Right. I mean, I wrote a story a long time ago for Mel Magazine about adult baby diaper lovers. And I met a guy in a cafe in Brooklyn who was wearing a diaper during our interview, and it was one of the most insightful experiences of my life. Like, it's something I will never forget. And I think it was a perfect way to round off a trip to New York, the Big Apple, where you can be walking air, but also you can also be walking with a big diaper. Best city in the world. Now, Chris, like, because it's your first time on, I asked just as I asked every guest, like, for a post to talk about, and you gave us one which isn't necessarily like a viral post or like one of those posts that people remember, but it kind of was an interesting, the going down the rabbit hole was a real experience for me. So you gave me this tweet by a guy called Andy Stone. And the tweet was posted on September 28th, 2021. And it says, speaking of tweens as a valuable and untapped audience, ... notice the cartoon cell phone. Now this is a screenshot of the New York Times, where the New York Times has a kids section for ages 8 to 13, and they have this like little cartoon of a headphone and like a, you know, just a normal phone. Now, to kind of an outside observer or someone who's used to reading unhinged posts, they might not understand what's going on, but you recently published a piece about Andy Stone, and that kind of adds context to this. So I wondered, could you, for readers who haven't read your piece and input, could you explain what's going on? Who is Andy Stone and why is he tweeting about children in a really weird way?
Yeah, so Andy Stone is essentially like a comic book villain henchman come to life on the internet, who is essentially doing his job through trolling posts. Like his job is posts, as far as I can tell. His job is to be a shit poster on Twitter for Facebook, basically. And like the reason why this lives rent-free in my head, and several of his tweets have in the past, but this is the one that's kind of just dominating at the minute, is that it's like the perfect encapsulation of like the myopic tech bro view that everything that they do is perfect and nothing could ever be wrong about it. So Andy Stone is basically Facebook's attack dog. He's their PR person whose job it is to try and head off all the negative stories about Facebook. And, you know, spoiler alert, I don't know if you've been reading the internet lately, but there are quite a lot of negative stories about Facebook right now. And so I did this story for Input, where basically it was just kind of, you know, in the same way that maybe your adult diaper wearing thing was triggered, sort of Hussein, in that you like think about something, go, what's the deal with this guy?
Yeah.
And the deal with Andy Stone was, he was just being an absolute shithead to lots of people on the internet. And I was kind of like, why are you doing that? And the answer seems to be that he's just a monumental dick, from what all the people who do PR were telling me.
Yeah. I feel like I was reading through some of his tweets, and like, again, like the stuff that you put in input, where he's kind of trying to kind of, it's this mixture of like shit posting, but it's also like him getting really, really mad at tech reporters for like pointing out like quite obvious things. And you're right. Like, it comes in this context of like there isn't really a lot of good press about, there isn't really a lot of like good press about Facebook. There isn't really a lot of, most people like generally, including even in tech, like do not have particularly good views about Facebook. And Facebook is also just trying to figure out like what it is at this point. Like, that's kind of the impression that I get. And I wonder whether like Andy Stone is an interesting insight into like a Facebook change of strategy, where like maybe back in like the early 2000s or like, you know, the early 2010s, when Facebook was kind of emerging as a thing, they were trying to be this like youth orientated, liberal, progressive organization, one that was like really at the forefront of like the advent of a tech revolution. And where now like that tech revolution hasn't seemed to come, Facebook have sort of like, while they've been aggressively trying to chase scale, they've also been aware that they're not ever going to get like public sympathy in the way that maybe they would have done in the past. So now perhaps Andy Stone is like representative of a different kind of more aggressive strategy, of one where it's like Facebook is saying like, we're here and you can't get rid of us. There's nothing you can do. So we can act in this really bizarre and unhinged way.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like the aging of a human being just by a big tech company and over a sort of much more telescope period of time. So like, you start young and, as you say, kind of very liberal and, you know, very wide-eyed and hopeful for the future, and you want to do good in the world. And then eventually you become like a cranky old man who is, you know, super racist and kind of like really right-wing and just angry at everyone and everything. And I feel like, you know, Facebook, that's, you know, that also probably describes quite a lot of the Facebook user base at the minute, I think. But it's fascinating to see this tech company kind of saying, yeah, you know what, we're too big. What are you going to do about it? And we're too big and we're doing things that aren't really great, but you don't like us anyway. So we're just going to live up to that and continue doing what we want, which is kind of a terrifying future for a tech skeptic tech reporter like me.
Mm. I mean, like, one, so I guess like the next question, that for people who aren't familiar with who Andy Stone is and Andy Stone's background, you kind of touched on it a little bit. Like, he kind of was involved in like DC politics before he moved into like Facebook. But yeah, like, what did you find out about Andy Stone when you were sort of like investigating who he was and like why he's kind of like taken on the type of posting that he has?
Yeah. So I think it's a fundamental difference between kind of tech PRs and politics PRs. And I think it's really interesting that Andy Stone has this history in Washington, D.C. and kind of the attack dog tendencies that come with that, of like us versus them, because a lot of the PRs that I spoke to, some of whom, you know, in the past have bridged both worlds, they kind of said that like a tech PR or a business PR is often focused on trying to tell like a long-term story about their companies and things like that. You know, they don't necessarily take it personally if they lose a single day's media wars. Whereas like in politics, obviously, if you do that, then you lose the momentum. And that's why you have, you know, absolutely crazy stuff happening in politics all the time. And I think that's kind of rubbing off a bit on Facebook, in terms of like Andy Stone has that political sensibility of you must always win, you must always be the victor. And sometimes you don't need to be. Sometimes you can just kind of not attack whistleblowers who are raising genuine concerns and give them ad hominem attacks.
Mm. I mean, you could do that.
You could, if you wanted to be, as you said, the super evil henchman in the Bond film. Like, you know, you could almost imagine him twirling his comical mustache and like doing his cackle.
Like, how does this like compare to other like tech PRs, though? Because like, or other like platform PRs, because it sort of feels like, you know, you probably know more about this than I do, because you report so much on like platform and industry and everything. But it sort of feels like we've kind of gone away from this kind of idea of like tech being like something that like is ostensibly like friendly, or something that you should kind of, it's something that's there to kind of like assist people, something that, or, you know, and maybe they were like never like this, but at least they kind of put on this perception of, you know, tech being a way of kind of like not only connecting people, but like also achieving like progressive political outcomes. It sort of seems at this point like everyone sort of accepted that's not going to be the case. And whereas like Facebook is getting a lot of like, is under a lot of fire because of like how it kind of like incubates extremists or like its kind of involvement in the January 6th, like March riot, whatever you want to call it. You have like other platforms that are seemingly like much more quiet, like places like TikTok and Twitter and everything. And I wondered whether like, how are these tech platforms reacting to both what is happening at Facebook at the moment? And are they like sort of consciously like learning lessons? Is there kind of a different like approach to how tech PRs like tell their stories to the public to like convince them that they are like good and worthwhile and not worthy of like criticism or dismantling or whatever?
Yeah, so I think the scales have dropped from a lot of both reporters' eyes and just like the general public's eyes. And you know, when that kind of dated back is obviously a really, you know, hotly debated question, but you've got kind of like, you know, the big Cambridge Analytica stuff is one of those, and you mentioned a few other big issues with lots of platforms. And you know, fundamentally, and I know we're probably going to chat about this at some point, like platforms are too big to kind of, you know, they're kind of like weird Frankenstein's monster in that, like, you know, they've been injected with all these steroids and human growth hormones and stuff like that. They've had the electricity kind of coursed through them, and then suddenly they're like lurching up and smashing stuff, and then you've got the people behind them going, oh no, we didn't mean that, because you know, we only wanted a little rinky-dink platform. I think what's interesting is, you know, from the conversation that I have, and it's interesting, you know, Andy Stone is an outlier at the minute in Facebook. I interact with a decent number of other PRs at Facebook who are actually really pleasant and really nice, and don't have to behave in the way that he does. But you know, tech PRs in other companies seem to kind of just be looking at Facebook and being like, we have no idea what's happening or why they're doing that, but we're really grateful and thankful that that's not currently us in the eye of the storm. And in terms of like avoiding falling into the same traps, like, you know, YouTube has had a lot of brickbats in the past, and I think it's kind of had the attention drawn away from it a little bit by the rise of TikTok. But certainly TikTok are like, they have a very deliberate PR strategy of like, they've looked at all of the issues that other platforms have faced in the past, whether it's a Facebook or a YouTube or whatever, and they try. They don't, certainly don't always succeed, but they try to, I think, head off some of those issues before they arise. And you know, they try and kill people by kindness a little bit. It doesn't mean that they don't get reported on sort of cynically and things like that, because they still do, you know, unfairly, but like, they seem much more conscious of the weight and the burden that comes with being a big tech platform in the eyes of reporters and the public as well.
Sorry, Phoebe, were you gonna say, did I just hear something again, or were you gonna say something?
No, I was just interested in talking a little bit more about the weight, about the kind of the life cycle of big tech, particularly big tech which markets itself as a sort of a communication and community building tool in the way that Facebook is sort of still trying to do, and how the life cycle of it is let it grow. Like, we can't really do anything. We can't get involved in digital infrastructure. We can't get government contracts. We're just a cutesy little messaging app, which is a place for people to put their photos. We can't do that stuff. And then it gets to a point where not only can they do that stuff, but they also have a kind of stranglehold on communications, and particularly communication that comes kind of large government contracts. So like last week with the outage, and it was basically determined that there were huge parts of the world who were basically left without other means of contact, because everything has been bought up and sort of franchised out to WhatsApp and other Facebook products. So when the outage took place, there were people who were sort of literally kind of sort of stranded and marooned with no means of communication, which was kind of missing from the general discussion in this country. And so then the life cycle goes, well, you can't, nothing you can do about our growth because it's just nice and fun and nice and fun and nice and fun. And then it gets to a point where they are simply too big to break up. And then that's when you have the kind of attack dog tendency, which is, well, you can't break us up. You're stuck with us now. Too much digital infrastructure relies on us. Sorry. And there's sort of no point at which there seems to be a kind of acceptable intervention. And I wonder what you think about that as somebody who has been doing tech reporting and like if there is any point which you can intervene acceptably or if it's just a case of just watching.
So this is a big thing, right? I'm a huge hypocrite because what I do is I stand outside the glass house and I throw stones and I have no real solutions. Like I did a podcast with Damien Collins, who is like, you know, an MP in the UK whose job it is to essentially try and like find these solutions. And he once said, like, what do you think the answer is? And I just sort of like shrugged my shoulders, went, I don't know, I'm not smart enough to think about that. Like, I just write the stories and then move on. But I think it's interesting because I think, I don't know what point you can step in and do something, but I kind of feel like that life cycle that you talked about, Phoebe, is partly maybe because we've just had in the early days and the early years of these platforms, and particularly like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, less so now like TikTok and Twitch and other things. But like we had regulators and politicians who just have like no idea how the internet works. Like they're not of that demographic. And so they can't even like get their heads around it. And you kind of saw that like embarrassingly in the Facebook hearings in the Senate when that guy was asking about are they going to ban Finsters without realizing that like that's just a like, you know, a logical impossibility. And you just kind of like, yes, you know, the internet is made of tubes and all that for 2021. But what I find really fascinating is like we're at a stage now where you have like AOC and others who are like, if they stream Among Us on Twitch and things like that, like they know how to put together an Instagram story that is actually quite engaging. And so we've had like decades of no regulation. We're currently in the midst of like a big tech backlash where we're possibly going to get over regulation, and then hopefully you start to get digital native politicians in the next sort of 5, 10, 20 years who actually, you know, can tell the nuances of like all this weird internet stuff that we all love. And maybe then you'll start to get a little bit more of a responsible regulation in there. But like, I don't know if you can just intervene at a certain point, really.
Yeah. And I guess I one of the questions I was going to ask was like, in relation to like Facebook's kind of concepts of what, how it wants to expand and like things like metaverse and stuff like that. I wonder like whether, I wonder whether like Facebook are kind of aware of this moment where it's like they're getting a lot of this criticism, but crucially they're getting criticism. Like the powerful people who can actually like make some sort of a substantive difference don't really know how to deal with something as not only as big as Facebook, but also as sort of like all encompassing. Like this kind of thing that is not just a tech company, but is by all extents like a utility, but one that can't really be kind of regulated like other kind of material utilities. And I wonder whether Facebook are kind of aware of this moment where or just like even kind of being able to exploit that, right?
And I think it's a couple of things, right? So it is, they're conscious of the fact that like their reckoning is coming in that way, but also potentially I think they are at a real moment where they're not the cool new thing anymore. And I think that's also kind of like an existential threat, which is why they are branching out so much. It's kind of why, I mean, it's why every single platform steals every other platform's features and then just makes them worse and copies them, and everything becomes this same homogenous mess of like, you know, disgusting Play-Doh that's just smushed into a ball. But like, it, you know, they're kind of being hit on both sides in terms of like there is the extinction risk, but then there's also the kind of poaching and, you know, being shot at risk, I suppose.
Mm. So in that case, like maybe we should like start, maybe we should like expand this conversation to talk about like platforms more broadly. And like, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we did an episode with Luke Bailey on what is content. And we tried to figure out what is content in relation to news and digital writing, and it brought up this broader question about, well, what is a platform, right? And like, how do they sort of interact with each other? Keen listeners and also purveyors of my life will know that I've just finished a master's degree in digital anthropology, in which a platform was defined by my tutor, Daniel Miller, who is also a leading digital anthropologist. He describes platforms as a group of technologies that are used as a base upon which other applications, processes, and technologies are developed. So basically what he's saying is that a platform exists as kind of like a conduit vehicle in which other kind of technologies are hosted and enacted. And like, you can, you know, the sort of platform really is just kind of like a place which allows things to exist. However, like, that definition, I think, was established, I think, in 2007. So we've come quite a long way since then. And I wondered, Chris, like, as a starting point of this conversation, as someone who has written about multiple platforms and experienced like how creators make stuff across these platforms, how should we be thinking about what a platform is today?
Yeah, so this is fascinating because Daniel Miller is amazing. I'm very jealous of the degree that you're doing, because it's like, it actually forms like the backbone and the skeleton to like all the weird things that we always think about in reporting. But like, to me, like that sort of classification still holds up to a certain extent, but it's very much focused on like the hardware and the tech and stuff. Like, to me, a platform is a place where, to like link back to Luke's conversation that you had, like, it's a place where you host content. It's a place where like conversations are mediated. I almost think now that like a platform isn't just like a technological layer, but it's also just like a social layer, because of the way that these platforms have become all pervasive in our lives. Like, you know, like Phoebe was talking about in terms of the outages in Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and the impact that that has. Like, to me, a platform is almost now not just a technological thing, but it's kind of like a public forum under private ownership.
Yeah.
And with that comes all of the issues of a public forum, where you expect sort of equality and you expect open access and you expect it to always be there. And the private ownership is the thing that holds you back, because it's not always there. It's not always equal. It's not always, you know, you can't just turn up at any time. You can't just rock up to the digital equivalent of Speaker's Corner. It's like you have to actually ask by... play Facebook's rules and follow them and things like that, which is really weird for a concept. I don't think we've kind of got our heads around that yet.
Yeah. I think that was like one of the difficult things that I was sort of wrestling with. Sorry, Phoebe, what were you going to say?
No, I was just saying to agree.
Okay.
That was just an agreeing noise.
Oh man, I hate Zoom so much. Okay. Anyway. Okay, what was I gonna say? Yeah, like, I think this was like one of the things that I was like sort of struggling with when I was like doing my dissertation and stuff, because a lot of my work was about kind of like communicative rituals. Very, very boring stuff. But it was this idea that like online and kind of online kind of platforms sort of represented the very few spaces in which like sort of people could interact with each other, and kind of a feeling that was autonomous and liberating. But when you really thought about it, it was like, and I think, Chris, you kind of alluded to this, where like platforms sort of imitate and copy each other. They also sort of like set these arbitrary limitations as to like how you can communicate, and they try to like codify and universalize it. So we've taken like one of the most kind of complex like aspects of human experience, which is how we actually interact with each other, and like the kind of nuances of communication and linguistics, and we've tried to kind of like what's happened is that it's been digitized in this sort of like kind of it's observed as like a standardized form, but you know, you still got humans who are interacting, and like we end up having this kind of great deal of, I don't know, like dissonance might not be the right word, but basically it's kind of like it sets these limitations on users across the board in terms of like how they sort of like express themselves and how they how they kind of relate to each other. And maybe that sort of kind of is one of the reasons why we have like so many kind of issues to do with like, you know, how like extremism is like incubated and how it kind of reproduces itself despite how many like regulations platforms do. So I kind of wonder what you think about the platform as a kind of communicative instrument, especially if I'm especially thinking about like TikTok here, where like as a video first service, like in theory, it sort of gives you, you know, because it kind of relies on the entire body for one to communicate, like it should kind of provide a much more fluid communicative experience. But I wonder whether it like faces the same limitations as a platform like Facebook.
Yeah. So this is where I come up with the big confession time for the podcast, which is that initially when TikTok came out, I really hated it and didn't think it was very, very good. And yeah. That's because I'm of the age where like Vine was my jam and Vine felt way more anarchic and more free in terms of like, you know, you talked about those constraints and the idea of like, maybe, you know, you think you're going to like a public park, but actually you realize that you're going to a prison and your day is very regimented and the communication that you have is, yeah, you can only respond in 5 different ways and they're all emojis to a single message. You know, you have to give a thumbs up or you have to give a heart or you have to give a fire emoji. And it's all, you know, all in that same very, very boring way. But TikTok to me originally, and it has kind of developed since then, because obviously, I guess as the, you know, the population of this country has developed, you start to get immigration, as it were, from other different platforms. You start to get sort of different viewpoints and different approaches. But like TikTok in its early days to me just seemed like Vine, but for the unimaginative. Like you were required to follow 1 of 5 or 6 different memes in order to actually like become viral. And you know, I still think that there's that idea of like, you know, rather than just like meme as we think of as the internet, to get like, and again, I love playing like pseudo intellectual academic because I'm not really very good at it, but like, you know, this is Hussein's thing, like meme versus mimetic, and like the idea of like you're kind of resorting to only communicating through a certain different set of formats, and there are only a few of them, in order to actually get your message out on TikTok. That's changed now, but you know, even just the idea of like you're kind of, you're channeled down into using certain sounds, or you're channeled into actually the video being a certain sort of setup payoff idea is fascinating to me. Is like it kind of, you know, gets rid of a lot of the imagination behind it.
Yeah, I had a TikTok and I did one TikTok and some kid like gave me a thumbs down and told me that I was old, and I never went back on it again. It not even worse. Joking. Like it wasn't even like a fancy one. It was just like, it was some song that I found, and I like, you know that kind of TikTok where like you have a tweet and then you like have your site, you're in front of it and you're like pointing to it and stuff. Right. And I just wanted to try it out. And I was just like, okay, this kid just like bodied me. I'm never going on there again.
I did book promo on TikTok, but I kind of stopped after that because I felt like it wasn't for me. I'm too old for it. But I mean, it could be worse. You could have done like the fatal journalist trick, which is every person that goes onto TikTok who is a journalist and is over the age of like 30 seemingly starts their TikTok career by doing the thing where they just point at text. Like they're sat in an office, probably wearing a suit, and they like say, you know, the upcoming by-elections in this constituency are X, Y, and Z. And it's just like, oh, it's like it's where ideas go to die.
Phoebe, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say that it's like interesting because I hadn't actually thought, because like I am also elderly enough to think very fondly of Vine. And I hadn't actually thought about how regimented TikTok trends are and how one has to be engaging in a mimetic experience in order to get anywhere using this platform. And yeah, it's just I'm just a bit taken aback by this thought, because I haven't really had it before. And do you think that part of its appeal and part of its, again, increasing stranglehold on very desirable markets is partly down to its repetitiveness and sort of how kind of comforting it is to see something recognizable just done again and again and again in different ways, and how little it is to do with invention or creativity? I mean, this is the thing. I might be being nostalgic and again extremely elderly, and maybe Vine was like that as well. But I remember it being a kind of democratized way of spreading very kind of short form comedy. And I feel like TikTok is less so. And I think part of it is that it's, and again, I don't know what you two think about that. I think part of it is that it's predicated around how incredibly easy it is to use. So the tools are like, they are so intuitive. They are making everyone who has access to the app, which is anyone with a smartphone, is capable of recording, editing, and playing a kind of like almost kind of like playing house of creativity, because its pretense is that it's a sort of democratized way of creating and a way of spreading your work, but actually it obscures how much the field of people who can actually make any kind of living or even any kind of profile off this sort of thing narrows and narrows and narrows and narrows, and also collapses upon like along the same lines that every aspect of society and culture collapses. But it's got this kind of pretense of ease and pretense of democracy kind of baked in.
Yeah, so I think there are two really interesting things to that. One is, as you say, like the ease of production is such that anybody can essentially do a TikTok, and it kind of then pushes you towards doing very easy stuff, even down to like the AI powered, you know, like video editor. Like you can, you know, give it a load of clips and give it the music that you want, and it will kind of cut them together pretty well for you, which is interesting in and of itself, because it kind of homogenizes everything. And I think it fits into like this broader idea, which is just that capitalism ruins everything, right? So
yeah.
It is a different generation of like online creativity. So, you know, TikTok is kind of like, it's fast food for like social media, in that it's not hugely nutritious. It is, as you say, comforting. It's like familiar. But it does kind of iron out all of the wrinkles that make people individual and interesting. And I think like it's the next sort of step along like the online video world. So, you know, you kind of look in generations, and like if you TikTok is the current generation, and you had like, you know, YouTube is the previous generation, and alongside that was kind of Vine partway through YouTube's history. And you know, almost around the time that like Vine was being anarchic and weird was also the time that YouTube almost shifted from like that lots of weird arty kids shooting home videos that they'd then share on the internet, like, you know, like a Dax Flame or, you know, Bo Burnham in his like, you know, original prime. They were doing like really weird stuff and just throwing it at the wall and seeing what worked. And then suddenly you start to see like money coming into that and people using that as a business, although like 96.5% of YouTubers don't make enough money from AdSense revenue to get over the US poverty line. But like that's kind of how like split the world is here. But then like people see this as an opportunity to make money, and they say, right, well, if I want to make money, then I need to copy what the most popular people are doing. And so you get this huge, just massive homogenized content, which isn't very interesting. And you know, the cool stuff, I guess, still exists, but as you know, algorithms are terrible, aren't they? So they serve us the thing that most people want rather than maybe the original stuff.
Mm. So like by extension, because like I wanted to like bring it back to Facebook just for a second, because obviously like when we're talking about like platforms like Facebook, we're also like talking about the kind of current context, which is not only like, you know, there have been like, as you mentioned, Chris, like there have been a number of scandals about Facebook that have come out in the past few weeks, like a lot of which has been very difficult to like keep on top of. The main one that I was looking at yesterday was the Facebook whistleblower, which is just one of the many scandals that Facebook is currently embroiled in, is the case of the Facebook whistleblower called Frances Haugen, who was identified in a 60 Minutes interview on Sunday when she filed out a number of complaints against Facebook and basically kind of accused the platform of putting profits before people. And that included shutting down, you're saying that the platform shut down research into extremism on its platform, that it kind of like she said that it magnified hate and misinformation, that her like personal friends of hers had been subject to like radicalization that had kind of primarily been driven by Facebook. Haugen was like someone who worked at other tech companies like Google and Pinterest before she joined Facebook in 2019. And she basically said that like all of Facebook's attempts to like fight misinformation and all its kind of PR, saying that it was like investing a lot into misinformation research, was really just kind of like, it was either like very, very exaggerated or like it didn't exist at all. She said that like regarding the 2020 election, that Facebook dissolved a unit on civic integrity where she had been working. And that was the moment she realized that I don't trust that they're willing to actually invest in what needs to be done to keep Facebook, so to stop Facebook from being dangerous. Since then, I think there's been like at least one other whistleblower that has wanted to come out, always come out to kind of like say that they are willing to testify before Congress about like Facebook's behavior. In the case of Facebook, as we've sort of seen with Andy Stone, but including like people like former Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, who I keep forgetting works at Facebook. I just keep forgetting that he works at Facebook. That these are kind of like exaggerations, or that Haugen and other whistleblowers are like weren't kind of working in the proximity where this was taking place. Basically trying to say that like, for all intents and purposes, that these are like lies. I mean, you know, and remember back when we did that episode about Nick Clegg's essay about Facebook radicalization, where he basically said that like, yeah, like it takes two to tango. Maybe if you don't really want to be radicalized, like don't log on.
Simply do not be radicalized.
Yeah, simply just, I mean, there wasn't even a solution, because it was kind of like, you're not really telling them to log off. No. We're just sort of telling them simply don't be radicalized, right? It feels like Facebook kind of are in this very peculiar position where any sort of meaningful active, like any meaningful kind of like intervention it would do on its platform to kind of reduce these types of dangers would mean, would kind of mean a detrimental change to like its entire business model, right? Like, and this is kind of the question that I think we keep coming back to, which is how can platforms like meaningly do this type of governance as private organizations or private like corporations, while also knowing that like the entire value of their corporations are based on like how big they are and how all encompassing they are and how crucially they like replace kind of, with, you know, their usefulness in like replacing transactions in everyday life. And that doesn't just apply to Facebook, but applies to like Amazon's and Google's, and it applies to, I mean, and it will probably apply to TikTok as well. So Chris, I sort of wanted to ask you about like whether you kind of identify a contradiction in those things, like apply, like if you're going to like meaningfully like reduce radicalization online, like that can't happen in a world where platforms exist.
No, it can't. And this is like the inherent issue, is that, so for the YouTube book, I spoke to a very, very early YouTube employee who was like one of the first maybe dozen or two dozen in the company. And they kind of realized at the time, at the very start, that there were issues in that occasionally, you know, videos would get surfaced that were like, you know, just hateful. They were just kind of like neo-Nazi style, right-wing, terrible videos, extremist stuff. And they kind of made a conscious decision at the time, because they were small, they thought, well, look, sunlight is the best disinfectant here. We, you know, we should have it on our platform because we can have the, you know, the voices of the masses kind of shout it down. And I think there's potentially an argument to be made, and it's a very like Silicon Valley libertarian argument, I think, still, but like there's an argument to be made that that works at a very, very small platform, but then all of these platforms grow very, very big, very, very quickly. And I think, you know, what's fascinating is it's either by like willful neglect, or it's just simply that they're not up to it, then all of these big tech platforms have this kind of reckoning at some point where they build something that is so popular, that it grows so fast, that they then are unable to control it at some point. I think, you know, it, either they're unable to control it, or they're unwilling to control it, because as you say, like the way they make money is through attention, right? And attention, you don't get that by, well, there are like, you know, YouTube niches of people who post videos about watching paint dry and things like that, and they probably make a lot of money because, you know, everything is content, and you know, we live in a creator economy now. But you know, generally content requires being kind of different or exciting or arousing or unusual in order to kind of like to become popular. And I think just humdrum stuff doesn't work anymore and probably never did. So there is this huge disincentive for platforms if they're running to try and get a profit to actually do anything about it. And that's even the case when we're kind of shouting about it as journalists from the outside.
Zoom keeps making me think that you're going to say something, and I'm not sure whether you are or whether you're not.
No, I am just making agreeing noises. Although I now do have something to say. So,
yeah, do say it. Yeah, please do say it. I'm just really worried that I'm going to like keep talking over you because of the lag and stuff.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. There's a lag on my end as well. It's just something that I wanted to. Like, we are going to try and do a proper episode on this at some point, but something that I think is, again, very much missing from this discussion is the mechanics of how the Facebook economy works, much in the way of sort of much in a kind of very similar way to basically all Western-based companies work, which is they have an economy partly based on exploitative outsourcing, and this is how the moderation works. So there was a few years ago there were a number of stories about the kind of the turnover of Facebook. It wasn't like a whistleblowing story, but it was like one or two people who had quit this job agreed to speak to journalists anonymously about being given kind of, you know, a day's training about how to wade through this extremely traumatic and troubling material that they would have to be wading through. And it was literally stuff like they were told, if it starts to get a bit much, then take a little break from your screen or go in one of Facebook's chill out pods or sit on a beanbag or, you know, whatever it is they've got over there. And they would sort of get kind of given sort of like a couple of therapy sessions, but sort of nowhere near enough to address the absolute kind of cavalcade of distressing images and videos that their job was to just look at all day long. And so they did what companies always do when they can't find people in the West who are willing to do it, which is they all outsource into the global South. And now there's this moderator class, like an outsourced moderator class, who are the backs on which the fight to moderate the alleged fight to moderate Facebook, because it is determined that it's not even really happening, are being built. There's not even something that I particularly want to kind of discuss about it, or at least certainly not now, because we don't really have time. But I feel like it is very missing from the discussion, and it's missing from the conceptualization of like what makes Facebook dangerous, and what makes Facebook something which is inimical to the health of the emotional, the economic health of the population.
Yeah, it's kind of like, so the big thing that I find really fascinating, and I don't know about Facebook because I'm not as well sourced in Facebook, but like YouTube and TikTok, people both on and off the record there have told me that they don't fully appreciate or understand quite what impact what they're doing has on ordinary people, which I find like frightening, to be honest. Like they've built this huge thing and they don't really know what its impact is off platform, or like, you know, the algorithm that they do, they're not certain really what it does or why it does it 100%. And they kind of, they just assume that everything will all be okay. And obviously it's not going to take over and have like its own sentience and stuff like that and start, you know, bringing us to heal as human beings. But it does have these pernicious effects, as you kind of described. And I think we don't really appreciate that yet.
Yeah, it kind of like goes back to something, you know, we said right at the beginning of the episode, where like things like digital anthropology and stuff, like, you know, the reason, like, I think, you know, the course was like so interesting to do, and the reason why I wanted to do it was because it was one of the few places where you could actually kind of understand technologies on a very like human level and think about like platforms as this sort of like social technology, right? So like what, like, you know, where, and it kind of conflicts with how we often talk about tech, which, you know, and even sort of like characters like Andy Stone like represent that, which is that all the criticism about Facebook is fundamentally a tech problem, right? That like, you know, you've identified a technology-based problems, and we are the only people with the technology and resources and scale to like resolve these problems, and that's why you should trust us. And I think that like if we change the conversation a bit to thinking about, okay, well, how are these technologies used in like social life, right? And like how, you know, things that, I mean, which we attempt to sort of do that on the show, but I think on a much more like, on like an academic level, but also like in a kind of industrial level, that we could do with a lot more thinking about like how these platforms, like how like platforms generally like mediate the way in which like people communicate, and like how they sort of make us like understand ourselves, and how we like relate to each other, and how the limitation of like the abilities to relate influences people both in like digital space and like offline. And crucially, the idea that like there is no meaningful kind of like separation between offline and online in like the vast majority of cases, right? Like, you know, and that's kind of like how platforms are designed, because they're designed to be these all-encompassing ubiquitous services. The whole design of them was is there so that you know, the platform, you know, so that like platforms are kind of always present, and you're kind of constantly thinking about like how your business or how your social relationship or how your like romantic relationship is kind of conceived of both online and offline too. It sort of feels as if like the, like if we kind of continue talking about platforms primarily as like tech instruments that require tech solutions, and all the problems that AI identifies are not social problems but tech problems, we're going to end up in this kind of loop where ultimately we keep going back to this point where, you know, as we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, these platforms are so big that there is no way that any kind of like external kind of point of governance or any like state, for example, can resolve these problems. So therefore we should just give them back to tech companies. And I think in a lot of ways, like, I wonder whether this is also like a deliberate play by tech companies to kind of frame problems in this specific way so that they retain their dominance, and like that, so that ultimately, regardless of what they do, what their causes and effects are, like no kind of, yeah, no like legal infrastructure, no political infrastructure actually thinks that it's possible to resolve these problems in any way that isn't sort of like tech deterministic.
I couldn't tell whether, I once asked a YouTube employee how they would fix the issue with their algorithm when, you know, it became clear that it was pushing people to more extremist content and, you know, red pilling them and stuff. And I couldn't tell whether or not this person was saying this because of like what you said, in that they wanted to keep their supremacy and their kind of, you know, their value in that chain of where you need us to be able to fix it because we've caused the problem, or whether it was just that they were so like blinded by like tech utopia. But they literally did say, well, possibly we could build another algorithm to try and tackle the algorithm. And I was like, that's surely the wrong answer there.
Yeah, and it's like the other thing too, where it's like whenever you ask them about algorithms, is also just like, even, you know, you like asking tech people about how their algorithms work on a social level is like near impossible. Like, I think there was a paper that I read like during my course about this, and how like tech, like both tech people and like users kind of have different kind of imaginings of how algorithms actually work, and often they sort of like contradict each other, and where there isn't like a language to describe how algorithms actually function or like what they even are as like kind of like material instruments, it's almost impossible to kind of like talk about how it sort of like affects other, like, well, you know, affects your kind of experience on like these tech platforms generally. I think so, like it keeps coming back to this, which is like maybe there needs to be like a development of language, like, and you know, how the way in which we like talk about platforms needs to sort of be reconsidered, or like the way in which you like sort of articulate how platforms actually work as like parts of our like social lives, because they are so pernicious that they do kind of affect every aspect of our lives. Like that language needs to sort of be in place before any kind of meaningful legislation or regulation can be in place. Again, like, but you know, maybe I'm also being quite cynical about this. Maybe actually, like, tech people have convinced all of us that the problems are so complicated that there's no way to kind of like resolve them. When actually, it's kind of like, yeah, you kind of just need the state, like, in, you know, you kind of just need like state intervention, or you sort of need like a state presence to like oversee it. And like, we've been convinced for so long that like the state should stay away from like, you know, not only private industry but tech specifically. That we can't imagine like any sort of, you know, existence where, you know, tech can actually work in like in conjunction with like how a society is organized within a nation state.
And that's horrifying, right? Like the fact that we're at that point.
Yeah, utterly horrifying. And also, I mean, like even given that as being the kind of the only option, I'm also not persuaded by the utility of state intervention, given what state intervention looks like in the main. Like, what I mean, like, imagine what Priti Patel's intervention might look like,
right? Yeah,
on platforms. Like, this is not something we should be hoping that they will be stepping into. I mean, like, a sort of gigantic expansion of Prevent, I don't think is necessarily what we should be thinking in terms of, and we'd have to be thinking very carefully about what such an intervention might look like and whether or not it would just sort of make things worse. I mean, when it comes to particularly platforms like Facebook and Twitter, I mean, they're very keen to suggest tech solutions for political and social problems. Which is a point I owe to our friends over at This Machine Kills, but it's not just that. It's that they've managed to maneuver the discourse into a place where they can come up with products to fix the things that they're responsible for, and they've positioned themselves as not just monopoly holders in terms of communications, and in terms of certain kind of aspects of kind of digital and social infrastructure, but as monopoly holders of fixing the problems that they created. It's pharmaceutical level of dastardliness. It really is.
I think that might be a good thing.
That might be a good depressing note to end it on.
No, I mean, like, look, I do kind of maybe actually a kind of point to end it on is like something slightly more positive. Like I don't know, like Chris, as you know, as a keen observer, I know I don't want to put pressure on you because I know that you've said, but like, you know, you like the rest of us, like, you don't want to kind of posit solutions. But is there like any kind of, like, you know, when you think about platforms and you think about the future of platforms, is like, do you kind of think that with the criticism being kind of placed on Facebook right now, but like actually this might be a good kind of at least like political sign that people are thinking critically about platforms, and that there is kind of a potential future where you know, you can have like where like platforms aren't sort of like left to sort of like self-govern, but they are kind of, they can be incorporated into at least kind of a functional legalistic, you know, form of regulation.
Yeah, no, I do. And for all that I'm down at the moment about what that looks like, because I think that we're not in a place to properly grapple with that, I do think that we are going to get to that point. And it comes back to that kind of like aging through the politicians. Do we get to like a group of tech literate people who can actually sort of sensibly talk about this stuff and then try and consider a more kind of holistic approach rather than, as you say, just either attacking the tech or attacking kind of the people behind the tech or whatever. But for the time being, like, we want to try and end on a happy note with that. But like, I think for the time being, we're going to have a rocky time because we're currently in the middle of like this huge battle for the future of big tech, where big government is really trying to claw back a lot of lost power that it's had disappear over the last decade or so. And so it will be tough for the foreseeable future. But I do hope that there will be kind of more sensible thinking around this whole thing, possibly led very much by this podcast.
I hope so. I hope so. We should, yeah, we should govern the internet. I think that I feel like that should be like our ambition for next year. We had like a modest Patreon goal for year one. Year two, we want to rule the internet.
Stretch goals.
That's right. We're going to bring back Flash Player. That's what we're going to do. We're bringing back Flash Player. Well, no, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sorry about the technical difficulties. Hopefully next time we will be able to use a better platform, ironically, to conduct the show. But like, if people want to read your work or read the stuff that you do, how can they do that?
So they can find me on Twitter. I am at Stokel, which is S-T-O-K-E-L. I do have a TikTok, but it's terrible. So I'm too ugly for the platform. So don't go visit that.
You don't want that kid. Yeah, you don't want that kid to like give you the thumbs down and like put you off. That kid was brutal, man. And if people want to like read your books, you've got two books out. You've got two books out at the moment. What are they and where can people get them?
So one of them is on YouTube, which is called YouTubers. One of them is on TikTok, which is called TikTok Boom. You can find them at your beneficent local Amazon taking over the world, or you know, you can try a local independent bookshop. That's always quite nice as well.
And I think they're both published by Canonbury, right?
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, so we'll put the links from the Canonbury stuff, from Canonbury in the show notes. But like, yeah, do get them from a local bookshop if you can. But no, they're both really good books. I haven't finished TikTok Boom just yet, but like I am definitely enjoying it so far. This was a free episode of 10k posts. We do have a Patreon, as we mentioned. It's patreon.com/10kpostpodcast. We do fortnightly bonus content. Check that out. It's $5 a month. You got some really fun stuff there, and like, yeah, it's just a laugh. You can follow me at hkizvani on twitter.com. It is a laugh sometimes, it's not, but
it's
most of the time
it's a bloody good laugh.
It's not the Seinfeld pod, but you know, we have some funny bits in there. Yeah, you can follow me at hkizvani on Twitter. You can also follow Trash Future. You can also follow Human Error. Like, that's on BBC Sounds. It's a show that I do with my friend Olga Koch, who's also been a guest of this show as well. Phoebe, how can people follow you if they are not familiar with the stuff that you do?
You can request to follow my Twitter at PRHRoy. You can follow me on Instagram at Phoebe_Rosa_Holly. And you can follow the extremely laugh-packed Seinfeld podcast that I do with Milo Edwards at Masters of Pod.
This show is produced by Devon. You can follow them at Devon_Unearth. Also listen to Kill James Bond, which is their podcast as well. We have a live show coming up November 10th. That live show is going to be at the Star of Kings. It's going to be with the Content Minds, who's hosted by Ryan Broderick and Luke Bailey, and a couple of other like really cool guests. There are some tickets left, so do get them while they're still there. They should still be around by the time this comes out. Yeah, and come like say hello to us, but not in a weird way. Be normal, otherwise you won't say hello back. All right, I think that's it from us. So without further ado, have a good day or night whenever you're listening to this, and catch you later.